Imagine a chunk of iron and nickel just drifting through the absolute zero vacuum of deep space.
Right, completely alone out there.
Exactly. It is entirely alone, and it's cooling down at a rate that is so incredibly, like, unimaginably slow. We're talking about its temperature dropping by just 1 single degree Celsius every million years.
Which is just a staggering amount of time when you really think about
It
it.
really is. And it makes you wonder, what happens to the internal structure of metal when time practically stands still? Well, welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we are bringing you on a journey to uncover a microscopic pattern that was literally born in the cosmos, but actually dictates the strength of the world around you.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal starting point for us today. What we're looking at is a highly specific structural phenomenon in material science.
Specifically within steel and iron alloys, right?
Exactly. And to unpack all this for you, we are pulling from a remarkably detailed transcript of a material science lecture. It's from a YouTube channel called Badeshio123.
Which is run by a major heavyweight in metallurgy.
Yeah, he really is. And we're pairing that lecture with a very dense webpage index on the exact same topic, just to make sure we've got all our bases covered.
Perfect. So the name of this cosmic phenomenon we're talking about, it's called Widmann-Stettin Ferret.
It's a bit of a mouthful.
Oh, totally. And
Yeah.
actually, just as a quick fun aside from the source notes, there's a researcher named Eric Jaegel who points out a funny spelling quirk.
Oh, right. The umlaut thing.
Yeah. He notes that if you were taking notes today and your keyboard doesn't happen to have the A umlaut, that A with the two little dots on top, the official alternative spelling is actually Widmann-Stettin with an E after the A.
So, tuck that away for your next highly specific spelling bee, I guess.
Exactly. But spelling quirks aside, our mission today is to follow this metallic structure from those meteorites traversing the universe down into a surprisingly heated modern-day debate over computer modeling.
And then finally, into a surprise cameo by an Italian tractor axle, which is probably my favorite part of the whole lecture.
It's so good. It really is a journey that scales all the way from the galactic to the atomic.
It is, but to understand how this structure affects the physical steel and like the buildings and machines you interact with every single day, we kind of have to start back at that meteorite.
Right, the one that cooled for millions of years.
Yeah. The name actually originates from this guy, Alois von Beck Widmann-Stettin. He was studying a space meteorite at the Imperial Porcelain Works over in Vienna.
Okay, so he's looking at this literal space rock.
Right.
What exactly did that million-year cooling process do to the metal inside of it?
Well, it essentially allowed nature to perform a perfect, completely undisturbed experiment. You see, when iron is at a really high temperature, it exists in a phase called austenite.
Austenite, got it.
Right. And you can think of austenite as this specific architectural arrangement of iron atoms. It's relatively
Like an
spacious.
open concept house.
That's a great way to visualize it. But as the metal cools down, it really wants to transform into a new phase called ferrite. And ferrite has a much tighter, different atomic arrangement.
Okay, so like moving from that big, spacious, open concept house into a very structured, tightly packed apartment building.
Exactly. And when this transition happens over, literally millions of years, the new ferrite doesn't just form randomly, it forms these massive, incredibly coarse plates.
And the sources mention they form along something called octahedral planes.
Yes, the octahedral planes of the parent austenite.
Let me just make sure I'm picturing this right for everyone. An octahedron is basically like two pyramids stuck together at their bases, right? Like an eight-sided die from a tabletop board game.
Yeah, that's spot on.
So the ferrite is basically growing outward along those specific flat geometric faces of the die.
Precisely. And because it had absolute eons to arrange itself perfectly in the vacuum of space, the Widmann-Stettin pattern in that meteorite was just massive.
Like you could just see it without a microscope.
So easily. It was this beautiful intersecting geometric lattice, completely visible to the naked eye. But, the story doesn't just stay in outer space.
Right, because we find it here on Earth too.
We do. Later on, one of the actual founding fathers of metallography, a man named Osmond, he was looking through a microscope at standard everyday steel ingots right here on Earth.
And he saw the same thing?
He noticed that exact same geometric plate pattern forming.
Wow. Just on a much more microscopic scale, I assume, since Earth's steel cools in what, hours or days, not millions of years?
Exactly. The time scale is totally different. But whether it's massive in a space meteorite or microscopic in a stealing it in a factory, the underlying structural problem remains exactly the same.
Wait, problem. Why is it a problem?
Well, when these Widmansstätten plates nucleate, so when they begin to grow out from the boundary of an austenite grain, they tend to grow in these parallel formations.
Meaning they stack up next to each other?
Yeah, all the plates coming from the same segment of that grain boundary, they share the exact same crystallographic orientation in three-dimensional space.
Okay, let's ground that concept a bit because crystallographic orientation sounds a bit dense for anyone who isn't actively working as a materials engineer.
Fair enough. Yeah, let's break it down.
If I'm understanding the lecture sources correctly, it's a lot like trying to chop a piece of wood. So if the wood grain is perfectly straight and all its fibers are running completely parallel to each other, you swing an axe and it splits right down the middle with almost no effort.
Right, the energy just travels straight through the parallel lines.
Exactly. But if you hit a knot in the wood, or if the grains are twisted and sort of crossing over one another in different directions, the wood actually absorbs the energy of the axe. It fights back, resist breaking.
That analogy absolutely hits the nail on the head. What you are describing in that piece of wood is the exact physical mechanism of what material scientists call a cleavage fracture in steel.
A cleavage fracture, that sounds bad.
It is. It's a really brittle, sudden, catastrophic failure where the metal basically just snaps. So if you want to stop a microscopic crack from spreading through, say, a steel beam, you really need internal boundaries that force the crack to constantly change its direction.
Because every time the crack has to pivot or turn, it loses energy.
Exactly.
So in metal, you actively want the equivalent of the knots and the twisted grains.
You absolutely do. And the source material highlights some really classic work to prove this. Back in 1967, Pickering explained how this internal crystallography plays just a massive role in cleavage.
And then there was Anne-Françoise Gorgues, right?
Yes, later on, she proved it definitively. She used this really advanced technique called electron backscattered diffraction.
That sounds intense. What did she actually prove with it?
Well, she and her team demonstrated that the physical visual size of the grain you see under a standard microscope isn't actually what matters for stopping a crack.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What actually matters is the crystallographic grain size, which means the actual physical alignment of the atoms themselves.
Okay, I see where this is going. Because all those parallel Widmansstätten plates share the exact same orientation, they don't force the crack to pivot or turn at all.
Not even a little bit. To a microscopic crack tearing through the metal, a whole packet of these parallel plates basically looks like one giant continuous superhighway. It just accelerates right through them.
Wow. Oh, but hang on a second. If this parallel structure acts like a superhighway for cracks and makes the steel potentially so brittle, why does it even form in the first place?
That is the big question, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it feels like the metal is just naturally organizing itself into this massive structural flaw.
It really does seem counterintuitive. But to answer why it forms, we have to zoom in even further. We have to leave the macro mechanics of how a crack spreads and look at the exact microscopic movement of the atoms themselves.
Okay, let's do it. How are the atoms moving?
Well, the way the structure builds itself is entirely unique. The lecture notes describe it as a displacive transformation.
Displacive transformation, okay.
Right. And it's controlled by the diffusion of carbon, and it happens above the T0 temperature.
Wait, I'm going to have to stop you there. My thermodynamic physics is definitely a bit rusty. What exactly is the T0 temperature?
Oh, fair point. Think of T0 as a sort of thermodynamic dividing line. It's the exact temperature where the parent austenite phase and the new ferrite phase have the exact same amount of free energy.
Meaning neither one is technically easier for the metal to maintain?
Exactly. Normally, for a transformation to happen without any atoms needing to slowly diffuse or migrate around, you usually have to be below this temperature.
Below it, because down there, the new phase is thermodynamically cheaper to exist in.
You got it. But Widmansstätten ferrite manages to form above this line, which is what makes it so mechanically fascinating.
So basically breaking the standard rules of how metal usually transforms, how does it pull that off?
The professor in the YouTube lecture gives this absolutely brilliant analogy to help visualize the atomic movement that makes this possible. He breaks down the way phases transform in steel into three different categories.
Right, the bus analogy. I found this so fascinating in the notes. Break down the three types for us.
Sure. So first, you have what's called a reconstructive transformation. Imagine a queue of everyday civilians waiting at a bus stop.
Okay, just normal people waiting around.
Yeah. And when the bus arrives, they all just kind of rush the doors randomly. They sit wherever they want next to whoever they want.
No assigned seats?
None at all. In the steel, this means there is zero atomic correspondence between the old phase and the new phase. The atoms just reshuffle randomly into whatever low energy position feels comfortable.
And because they're relaxed and just taking whatever seat is open, the overall physical strain on the metal is quite low, right?
Exactly. That is your civilian transformation.
It's chaotic, but everybody is comfortable. Nobody is being forced into a weird, stressful position.
Right. Now, on the far opposite end of the spectrum, you have a Martensitic transformation. This is the purely military approach.
Military lockstep.
Exactly. Imagine a line of highly disciplined soldiers. When they board the transport bus, they board in exact sequential order. They sit down in the exact same physical arrangement they were standing in outside.
So, like, soldier number three is still sitting exactly next to soldier number four.
Yes. There is perfect atomic correspondence. The entire lattice just shifts as a single rigid unit.
But I'm guessing that comes with a downside.
A big one. Because they are forced to maintain that exact rigid structure in a new, tighter environment on the bus, it creates a massive amount of strain energy.
Like compressing a heavy metal spring?
Yeah.
The metal is just physically stressed out.
Exactly. So we have the relaxed civilian scramble and the highly stressed military lockstep.
Okay, so where does our cosmic meteorite structure, the Widmanstätten ferrite, actually fit into this picture?
It sits right dead in the middle. The professor calls it a paramilitary transformation.
Or amilitary. How does that work?
Well, remember, steel isn't just pure iron, right? It has smaller carbon atoms sitting in the empty spaces between the much larger iron atom.
Right, the carbon is what makes it steel.
Exactly. So when Widmanstätten ferrite forms, it delegates. The small carbon atoms, they act like the civilians.
Oh, they just scatter.
Yeah, they rush freely onto the bus. They diffuse away from the growing plate to find a comfortable, low-energy state somewhere else.
But what about the large iron atoms?
The large iron atoms maintain strict military discipline. They move in a highly coordinated, displacive shift, perfectly maintaining their atomic correspondence with the parent phase.
Wait, I'm trying to work through the logic of this physically. If the small carbon atoms are fleeing the scene, but those massive, heavy iron atoms are still forcing themselves into a new geometric structure without breaking ranks.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that still warp the metal? Like, shouldn't the steel just shatter from the internal physical stress of that massive, displacive shift?
You've hit on the exact physical problem the steel faces. The strain energy is absolutely massive. But what's beautiful about this is how the structure literally bends to solve its own problem.
What do you mean it bends?
The steel accommodates that huge strain energy through the actual physical shape the plates take as they grow. When researchers finally observed this happening in real time...
Wait, they watched it happen live?
Yeah, under a high-temperature confocal laser microscope. And they saw that the plates don't grow as these flat, isolated sheets. They actually grow in pairs.
They team up.
They do. Imagine you have a thick, heavy phone book sitting on a table. If you push the top cover really hard to the left, all the pages slide and slant sideways to the left, right?
Yeah, that makes sense.
That's called shear deformation. Now, imagine a microscopic plate of Widmanstätten ferrite doing that exact same thing to the solid steel. To stop the steel from tearing apart from that extreme leftward slant, a second plate instantly forms right next to it.
Let me guess, pushing to the right.
Exactly. It acts like a phone book being pushed hard to the right. So they physically lean into each other like a pitched tent.
Oh, wow. So the left-leaning force and the right-leaning force literally lock together at the top of the tent. And they just perfectly cancel each other's stress out.
Precisely. By growing together in this mutually accommodating tent shape, they neutralize the strain energy. And that incredible balancing act is exactly how they managed to form above that T0 temperature we talked about earlier.
That is just wild. Mm. And this unique paramilitary growth process, it gives the structure a very distinct visual quirk under a microscope.
Oh, yes. The lecture mentioned how it reacts to being chemically etched for observation in the lab.
Right, the etching process.
Yeah.
How does it look compared to other things?
Well, the professor points out that if you look at another phase in steel, like bainite, under an etched microscope, it looks really dark and muddy.
Why is it muddy?
Because what looks like one solid plate of bainite is actually thousands of tiny subplatelets completely cluttered with trapped carbon particles. It's just a total mess inside.
But the Widmanstätten ferrite is different.
Completely different, because it acts like a literal snowplow, pushing all those civilian carbon atoms totally out of the way while the iron atoms lock arms and shift into that tent shape. It etches completely white.
White.
Yeah. There is zero internal clutter. It is structurally pure.
So we have this beautifully pure, mechanically self-balancing tent structure born from a paramilitary dance of atoms. I mean, it honestly sounds like material scientists have this completely figured out.
You would think so, wouldn't you?
Yeah. But this is exactly where our source material takes a very sharp turn into some deep academic drama. Because this growth mechanism is so highly specific, it's apparently causing an absolute crisis in the world of computer modeling.
Crisis might honestly be putting it mildly. The professor in the lecture gets quite fired up about this specific issue.
He really does. What's the core of the argument?
He's pushing back really hard against a large group of scientists who are trying to use something called phase field theory to mathematically model how Widmanstätten ferrite grows in new alloys.
And from what I read in the index, the root of the argument is that these computer modelers are basically trying to treat solid steel as if it were ice forming in a puddle of water.
That is the exact friction point, yeah. If you think about a freezing winter morning and you watch frost or ice dendrites creep across a car windshield, they create these beautiful, branching, needle-like shapes.
Right, like fern leaves almost.
Exactly. And visually, they look remarkably similar to Widmanstätten ferrite plates. Now, in water, that branching shape happens because of something called interface instability.
Let's break that down for the listeners. What is actually causing the instability on the windshield?
Okay, so as liquid water turns into solid ice, it actually releases a tiny bit of latent heat. This creates what physicists call an undercooling diffusion field right at the microscopic edge of the ice.
A heat field, basically.
Right. So if a tiny random bump forms on the edge of the ice, that bump reaches further out into the colder, unwarmed water. And because it's in colder water, it freezes faster.
And because it freezes faster, it grows longer, which makes it bump out even further.
You see where this is going? Suddenly, a runaway reaction creates a long branching dendrite.
Okay, I follow the windshield frost. That makes perfect sense. So the computer modelers looked at the solid steel and said, hey, Widmanstätten ferrite sheds carbon as it grows, creating a diffusion field of carbon ahead of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's exactly like the ice shedding heat.
Yep, that was their logic. Let's just take the math for freezing water and apply it directly to solid steel.
So they just assumed the structure only grows because of that carbon diffusion field, creating interface instability.
Exactly. But the professor points out a fatal, undeniable flaw in that assumption. Widmanstätten ferrite doesn't actually need carbon to form.
Wait, it doesn't? But we literally just talked about the civilian carbon atoms fleeing the bus.
We did, but that's in standard steel. Metallurgists also make what are called interstitial-free alloys.
Interstitial-free? What does that mean?
These are ultra-high purity iron alloys that contain absolutely zero carbon. They are entirely carbon-free. And guess what forms perfectly inside them anyway?
Widmanstätten ferrite.
Exactly.
But if there's no carbon, then there is no carbon diffusion field.
You nailed it. There is no diffusion field to create that interface instability. The entire mathematical model based on ice completely shatters because the fundamental physical engine driving the growth is just different.
Wow.
Yeah. Widmanstätten ferrite isn't driven by an unstable diffusion field. It is driven by the internal strain energy and the displacive shift of those military iron atoms we talked about.
So it's basically like scientists trying to predict a chess game using the rulebook for checkers.
That is a brilliant way to frame it.
I mean, sure, the game takes place on the exact same board and the pieces slide across the squares, but the underlying mechanics of why the pieces are allowed to move are fundamentally wrong.
Exactly. And to make their checkers math work for a chess game, the professor notes that these phase field theorists are literally forced to program what he calls ridiculous levels of anisotropy into their computer models.
Anisotropy, meaning they are artificially telling the computer to favor growth in one specific direction.
Yes, because the underlying physics equation they are using is just wrong. The raw computer simulation just creates a round blob instead of a plate.
Oh, that's hilarious.
So the modelers literally have to hard code a cheat into the software, forcing the digital metal to stretch out into a plate just to make the final picture look right on the screen.
Which totally defeats the entire purpose of a predictive computer model. If you have to manually cheat the math to get the result you want, you haven't actually learned anything about the material.
Precisely. You're just drawing a picture with code at that point. Instead, the professor heavily advocates for using software like MUCG46, which is referenced heavily in the lecture.
MUCG46, what does that do differently?
Well, this software doesn't rely on visual tricks. It successfully predicts phase transformations based on the actual thermodynamic driving force and the stored strain energy of the specific atoms.
And what I found so amazing about that software is that it proves mathematically that not all steels are created equal. You can't just force any steel to do whatever you want.
No, you really cannot. The chemical recipe dictates the physical reality. The professor gives this stark example of a specific steel alloy used in power plants, which contains exactly 9% chromium and 0.1% carbon.
Okay, very specific recipe.
Very. And because of the specific thermodynamic math of those exact elements, you can heat it and cool it however you want, but you will only ever get other phases, like bainite and martensite.
So Widmansted and ferrite just won't happen.
It is mathematically, physically impossible for it to ever form in that specific power plant steel.
That's incredible. Okay, but if these computer models are so fiercely debated and some of the math being used in the industry is just fundamentally broken, how are engineers on the ground actually building things?
It's a fair concern.
Yeah, are they just flying blind? Because earlier we established this structure is a literal superhighway for cracks, which sounds terrifying for, you know, infrastructure.
Thankfully, no, they aren't flying blind. They rely on decades of real empirical testing and thermomechanical processing. As you mentioned, the heavy industry world generally views Widmansted and ferrite as a massive liability.
Right. If you're forging structural high beams for a skyscraper or designing welding alloys that hold bridges together, you need maximum toughness. A brittle superhighway is a disaster.
Exactly.
So how do they actively fight it on the factory floor?
The primary method is by carefully controlling how the metal is physically rolled and cooled to dramatically reduce the size of the initial austenite grains, those rooms we talked about earlier.
Oh, so they just make the initial rooms smaller.
Yeah. If the parent grain size is very small, it literally chokes out the parallel plates. They don't have enough physical runway to gain momentum, which forces a different, tougher, more chaotic, microscopic structure to take over and deflect any potential cracks.
So they just crowd it out. That's clever. But just when you think the whole goal of modern metallurgy is to hunt down and eliminate this structure, the end of the lecture transcript features this amazing Q&A session.
Oh, I love this part.
A student named Francesca chimes in from Italy.
Yeah.
And she completely flips the script on the professor.
It is just a fantastic moment of real-world application. The entire lecture has been about understanding the displacive mechanics of this structure and, implicitly, how to control or suppress it for safety.
Right.
And Francesca essentially raises her hand and says, "This is fascinating, but I actually have the exact opposite problem. I need to promote the formation of Widmansted and ferrite."
She wants more of it.
Yeah. She says, "I need more of it, and I'm having trouble getting it to form reliably."
And the professor is just completely taken aback. He asks her what in the world she is building that actually requires this brittle parallel superhighway.
And her answer is incredibly specific. She's working with medium carbon grades of steel, alloyed with manganese and chromium, and her end product. She is manufacturing axles for heavy tractors and agricultural vehicles.
Which is so brilliant when you think about it. I mean, a skyscraper beam has to handle a massive static, unmoving load. But a tractor axle is experiencing a completely different type of dynamic stress as it churns through rocky, uneven soil.
Exactly. For that highly specific dynamic load and that specific chemical recipe of manganese and chromium, the Widmansted structure isn't a flaw at all.
It's a feature.
It is exactly the mechanical profile the engineers require for the axle to survive the field.
The professor is so surprised and delighted by this that he actually asks her to send him her research article so he can learn from her.
Which is just a great moment of academic humility, honestly.
It really is. And that exchange perfectly illustrates the ultimate beauty of material science. After all the intense thermodynamic physics and academic debates over computer codes, the final truth is that there are no inherently bad microscopic structures.
None at all.
There is only the right structure for the exact right application.
It is a phenomenal takeaway.
So let's quickly recap the sheer scale of the journey we've taken you on today. We started with meteorites cooling by a single degree every million years in the absolute deep freeze of space.
Then we zoomed all the way down to the microscopic level to witness a paramilitary dance where civilian carbon atoms flee while iron atoms march in strict formation,
building those interlocking tents to cancel out their own physical stress. Then we waded into the academic drama of why ice dendrite math shatters when faced with pure carbon-free iron.
And finally, we landed in a field in Italy where that exact same cosmic structure is deliberately engineered into the spinning axles of heavy tractors.
It's just wild.
It is. And as we wrap up, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over, kind of building on the sheer physics of what we just explored today.
Okay, let's hear.
Think about the fact that this incredibly rigid paramilitary structure requires the perfectly slow, zero-gravity, vacuum environment of deep space to naturally grow into those massive, beautiful, naked-eye geometric patterns von Beck-Widmann-Stetten first saw.
Right. Wasn't the meteorite.
Yeah. It makes you wonder, what happens a few decades from now when humanity begins seriously manufacturing and forging steel structures in orbit?
Oh, wow.
Right. If we intentionally harness the vacuum and the extreme temperatures of space as a literal foundry, could we grow massive, structurally pure supermaterials that are mathematically impossible to forge under the gravity and cooling constraints here on Earth?
Oh, that is a completely wild thought. We spent all this time fighting it in factories here on Earth, but the ultimate forge might actually be waiting for us up in orbit.
Exactly. It really changes your perspective.
It really makes you look at a simple piece of steel completely differently. Well, that is going to do it for our deep dive today. Thank you so much for joining us, for exploring the atomic dances and cosmic origins of the materials that silently hold up our world. Keep asking questions, keep looking closer at the structures around you, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.